begin the lesson. So we are exactly halfway through this lesson, the title of which is Transcending a Religion of Fear. There are four parts to the lesson. We've done two of those parts so far. Part one, we were setting some important context for the lesson. In essence, we were saying that fear is hardwired into our brains and fear is hardwired into our bodies. It's never going to go away. It keeps us alive. It motivates us. It's a survival strategy. So why are our ancient texts, why is the wisdom of our tradition so insistent that God has not given us a spirit of fear? Why is our tradition, why are our texts so repetitive in the refrain of coming to us again and again saying, fear not, fear not, fear not? Fear can motivate us. But we saw in the original part of the first part, fear can also immobilize us. Fear can keep us alive. It can also kill us. It's a complicated soup, this fear of ours. But our tradition teaches us our body's responses to fear and our brain responses to fear are not the whole story around fear. There is, our forebears testify, a process by which we can awaken to a transformed relationship with and an altered experience of our fear. So if you missed part one, I'd encourage you to go back online and have a listen. Then in part two, we begin the balance of the lesson to explore ancient strategies that will point us toward that experience, point us toward the experience of transforming our relationship with fear. The first of those was to go toward our fear and to not follow our brain's wired-in instincts to avoid. Because here's what our brains do. They say, don't look at that fear, look over here. Because when we look at our fear, it is powerful and can sometimes overrun, overwhelm us. And so to keep an interior equilibrium, we have been taught by our brains to avoid it so that we can go out and do what needs to be done. And our tradition teaches us, don't do that. Enough of that happens instinctively. That's something that not only helps us survive, but it will also swamp us. So let's push against that instinct and let us push against those distraction strategies. Instead, our tradition teaches us, here's a whole bunch of practices that will help you push against your innate instinctive tendency to avoid feeling your fear. So we ended part two last week with a lesson titled Discerning Your Bent for Lent. And we can thank Michelle for our clever strategy, for our clever titles of our lesson. She's the one that titles them. Each of us has a bent. We've got a default strategy for fear avoidance. And Lenten custom is to spend some time discerning interior habitual go-to strategies that we deploy in order to avoid something in our lives. In our case, we're looking at avoid feeling our fears. And so it is Lenten tradition to engage some practice that is designed to push up against those habitual go-to habits, to push up against those strategies for distraction that would keep us from feeling our fear. So I've been encouraged by how creative our community has been. Many of us are engaging not doing something strategies, and some of us are engaging doing something strategies, but all of them part of our tradition's wisdom to use these practices to push up against some habitual part of our lives. One of the stories that I heard this week, I thought I would share with you because it was I thought it was very creative, kind of insightful. There's a guy in our community who has a go-to instinct. It's not an uncommon one. It's a go-to fear avoidance strategy that helps him feel good about himself and helps him feel good about his role on the earth, and that is this. He is a fixer. He fixes problems. He fixes problems on his job. He fixes problems with his family. He's a fixer. And when he fixes, he senses his place on the earth. He feels needed. He feels valued. He feels appreciated. He feels respected. But as we always say, rarely is the thing the thing. Usually the thing is the thing under the thing. And so he's been doing this self-awareness, self-disclosure process long enough now that he's gotten a little bit of awareness of the thing under the thing. And so when he deploys his fixer persona, he realizes the thing under that is that it helps him feel protected. When he's fixing problems for folks, folks need him. And more pointedly, given his history and his experience, he said, he realizes that people won't leave him. People won't abandon him. He won't be deserted by the people that he needs. He won't be deserted by the people that he loves. So he fixes. So for him, that dynamic is often the thing under the thing. It is under a lot of his afflictive episodes in his life that that is somehow working in the background, that is somehow in play. So for Lent, he told me, he's giving up fixing. He's making himself not fix anything unless someone asks him directly to fix something. So he was telling about his wife calling him since Lent started with a computer acting up. And he immediately said, my brain kicked into, I need to act, I need to do something. How can I fix her computer for her? It's going to be a bit of a challenge because I'm 20 miles away, I'm at work, but I'm the fixer man. This should be what I'm doing. And he said, as he was telling me the story, it's crazy. I know it is, because there's nothing I can really do to fix her problem right now. And she's not even asking me to fix her problem. She's just mentioning it because we're on the phone together. But not being able to do the thing that I do, it's making me crazy inside. If I can't fill my role, I'm going to have to feel my feelings. So maybe I could remote access her computer from here. Maybe I could. And so he's trying to get into his fixing mode. And he said, as he was telling me, I know how silly it sounds. When I say it out loud, I know it sounds silly. In fact, he was laughing while he was telling me about this thing. And he says, really, is that what I do? What is with me? I know I can laugh at it, it doesn't change. I still do it. Or more accurately, it is done to me by this habit of mine. So he said, that's what I'm doing. I am giving up fixing for Lent. Somebody has a need, someone has a problem, a challenge, some kind of a trouble, and I do nothing. I don't make a suggestion, I don't offer to help, I don't fix, I don't make it better. And he said, everything inside of me screams that I should be doing it, and I don't. And damn, he said, this is not easy. I did not realize how deeply I depend upon my be the fixer guy strategy to not have to feel these feelings inside. So I'm feeling my feelings this Lent. I'm feeling the threat of abandonment. I'm feeling it. I'm feeling the threat of my irrelevance to people. I'm feeling it. I'm feeling all this discomfort. And he said, that's my Lent, 6 weeks of it. And thanks a lot, Doug. And I do hope you're engaging some practice. I do hope you're going toward your fear. I do hope that you are participating in what our tradition says is so uncomfortable, but on the other side of which is a transformed experience of fear. Now, that brings us to midway in the lesson. We've done two of the four parts, and so if you missed any of those, I would encourage you to have a listen online. The remaining two parts are also strategies for experiencing a transformed relationship with fear. We've just finished looking at the ancient wisdom that tells us to go toward our fear. Next, we'll look at the wisdom that tells us to go toward our neighbor. And then finally, we'll end up in a few weeks looking at our wisdom that tells us to go toward our enemy. Going toward our fear, going toward our neighbor, going toward our enemy. So today we begin a few weeks of exploration of that second one. Moving toward our neighbor, a strategy for transforming our experience of fear. So, a couple weeks ago, George, during our music time, referenced some of the beginning verses of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. You can find that in Matthew 5. And he mentioned how many of the nouns that were used were put into the plural and many of the verbs matched the plural. And he said, given that that's the way that the grammar is structured, we could use the second person plural that we don't really have in our language unless you happen to be Southern. And so we could use the Southern second person plural. We could use y'all or y'all to talk about these first verses in the Sermon on the Mount. So I have paraphrased some of them. I just selected a few of them. I've put the second person Southern in, and here they are. You ready? Blessed are y'all when you practice humility, because together you get to experience heaven on earth, and the implication of that being that humble people are lovely to love. Blessed are y'all when you mourn, because together you comfort one another. Blessed are y'all when you are selfless and kind. Together you experience what everybody wants in life. Blessed are y'all when you extend mercy. When you're together, you also receive mercy. And blessed are you all, when your hearts are pure. Because every time you're together, you see God. You see God in one another. I remember a professor, when I was in graduate school, stressing how difficult it is for us as Westerners to understand the letters of Paul. You know, if you're familiar with the New Testament, that from the book of Acts on, for the next several verses, for next several books, a lot of those were written by Paul as letters to communities all around the Middle East. And he was saying, this professor, that we live in such a highly individualized society that we bring that individualized perspective, that individualized instinct, to our interpretation of these letters, but they were not written in an individualized society. They were written in a highly communal society. He said, back then, nobody had a quiet time to read one of Paul's letters alone by themselves. No, what they did is they gathered together and read them aloud. They received them together. They interpreted them together. They applied them together. These were letters written to us, not letters written to me. As individualized as our society is, however, and the lenses that we wear when we come to everything, when we look at things, it's difficult for us to understand Paul. It's difficult for us to understand Jesus and these blessing proverbs, because we tend to think of it as me as opposed to us. And so our interpretation is lacking because of that. It's difficult to understand a lot of our ancient texts because they depended upon the communal context of the readers. They depended upon the togetherness component of wisdom. That was just baked right into the system for them, and it is not baked into the system for us. It is counterintuitive for us as interpreters. In other words, for them, wisdom wasn't wisdom if it wasn't applied in a together context. Wisdom wasn't wisdom if it wasn't wisdom for all of us together. Individual liberty, the individual pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, this has had a tremendous upside for us as Westerners. But it has also made us blind to some of the deepest wisdom of our ancient past. We just don't see very clearly. So, in other lessons, we have explored this concept, oneness versus two-ness. And if you're not familiar with that, search our audio files, our audio archives, and just put in that term, oneness versus two-ness. And you'll hear several lessons that were part of a series a long time ago, and then several references since then, about how our generation lives at a time of unique convergence between scientific understanding and spiritual understanding. Because now we have the language of physics to help us understand what the mystics have long taught us, and that is that the deeper reality of the world that we live in is that we are connected one to another. The deeper reality of the world that we live in is that everything is connected. As much as we feel, as much as we intuit the concept of discrete packages of separateness, we are connected more than we are separate. We are more one than we are two. Now, in the past, I've used the metaphor of the aspen grove to talk about this. An aspen grove looks, for all intents and purposes, like a collection of individual trees, separate trunks. We assume there would be separate root systems, but that's not the way an aspen works at all, not at all. It is one organism. It has one root ball. Each one of those trees shares the same DNA. Each one draws from the same organism. And we, in that metaphor, are more like the aspen than we are like individual separate entities. We and the earth and the trees and the animals are like that. We are a connected oneness that only looks like it is a two-ness. And so the mystics of our tradition intuited this a long time ago. Yes, we are a multifaceted organism, to be sure, but we are one organism. And yes, we're caught up in the illusion of separateness. Sure we are. But we are one organism. We just feel like we are two. We feel our separation. You and me are more one than two. You and me and the Muslim terrorist are more one than two. You and me and black lives and blue lives are more one than two. You and me and trees and birds and fish are more one than two. Now, boy, do we feel the two-ness. We really do. But the deeper reality is that we are more one than we are two. You and me and the divine reality that we call God, we are more one than we are two. We certainly feel our separateness. We feel our two-ness. But the tradition teaches us, but the world of physics is giving us language to now discuss, we are more one than two. For all of our illusions of separateness and discreteness, we are connected inextricably. For all of our illusions of separateness and discreteness, we are bonded together in a way that cannot be unbound. We can only understand us fully in a connection system of us-them being part of a oneness. We can only truly be ourselves in a connection system of being connected one to another. And that our ancient texts often intuited. Sometimes they referenced the two-ness reality, but regularly, recurringly throughout the generations, our ancient texts intuited this. Our ancient contemplatives intuited this. Contemplatives of other traditions intuit this. It is a truth that we cannot leave behind. We do, because of our illusions of separateness. But no matter how much we try and us versus them our way through our world, this is a truth that cannot be left behind. Every time we do, we live in a world that is not. Every time we do build our world on the basis of two-ness instead of oneness, we live in a world of our own making. And every time we do, we live in a world that will inevitably not work for us because it's a pretend world. It's an illusion world. It's a false world. The world is not a two-ness reality. The world is a oneness reality. The world that, as it truly is an everything is connected world. The world as it truly is, notwithstanding how difficult this is to intuit, the world as it truly is a oneness world. So, when we build our lives, as we so regularly do, on a foundation of discrete separateness, well, of course we get afraid. We should get afraid. We have to get afraid. Because the world doesn't stop being the way that it is just because of our persistent illusion predicting that it should be another way. Illusion is illusion, and separateness is illusion. So when we build our lives on the foundation of our instincts, instincts rooted in that illusion of separateness, we can't help but build worlds of non-community. And we can't help but build worlds of non-oneness. And we can't help but build worlds and build lives that don't work over the long haul. Because truth doesn't stop being true just because we don't believe it. And the truth is, everything is connected. You and I are connected. We exist in a web of unbreakable bonds. Stop being connected to one another, and we stop being. I hope you took up the invitation this last month or so to listen to the collected speeches and sermons of Martin Luther King. You can get it for free on Amazon if you're a member of Prime. If you're not, it's $6 for the MP3s. But if you did, you heard a term on a regular basis, the beloved community. Beloved community is the root ball under the surface. The beloved community is the truer true and the deeper true. Yours and my individual lives, that's the smaller truth. They are the smaller truths. Yours and my individual lives, these are the aspen trunks. But under the surface, difficult to see, under the surface, hard to discern, under the surface, the individual parts are in fact one, are in fact the beloved community. The ancient wisdom teaches us this. The mystics of our tradition teach us this. The contemplatives of every other tradition teach it as well. And for the last 100 years, our physicists have also been teaching us the same thing. Reality is a connected oneness more than it is a divided two-ness. Everything is connected. We are, every one of us, part of a connected wholeness. But boy, do our illusions betray us. Boy, are we blinded to this deeper reality, a persistent illusion of separateness. Case in point, you do something or say something, and my feelings are hurt. And now, the power of that illusion begins to take on this fiery life of its own, because the power of emotional reaction now gets to overrun me, and those cascading chemical reactions that happen when I have a fight or flight response begin to reinforce the illusion, because now there is me, the innocent party in this egregious episode, and there is you, the guilty party in this egregious episode. And so now I start building my life separate from yours, because you, separate entity, hurt me, separate entity, so now I'm going to avoid you. You, separate entity, hurt my feelings, so now I'm going to detach myself from you. You hurt my feelings, and so now I'm going to feel morally superior to you. You hurt my feelings, so now I'm going to build a life without you in it. I'm going to give you that side of the city, and I'm going to take this side of the city, and nary the twain shall meet. And the world being as big as it has been for a long, long time, that'll work for a little bit, for a while. I don't have to deal with you. And I don't have to experience you, and I don't have to see you, and I don't have to feel the feelings that you evoke inside of me. And so for a bit, I get to believe my illusion of separateness. For a little bit, I get to work it, because my disconnectedness will work for me for a little while. But it only works partially, and it only works for a while. Because it isn't true. It isn't the way the universe works. But you've had those experiences. You've separated yourself from someone who hurt you. You've been part of this reinforcement of the persistent illusion. I have been. It's what we do. We all think these thoughts. And because we all think these separateness thoughts, then when we talk to one another, we can reinforce those thoughts for each other. So how in the world are we going to break out of this illusion if we feel it so deeply and if we keep reinforcing it to one another? How do we do that? Because we sure think that our illusion is truth, whether it is or not. Well, with that reinforcing power, with the chemical parts of our brains so participating in the illusion, it is no wonder that we walk around with a deep commitment to the illusion of separateness, and it is no wonder that we walk around carrying a deep sense of interior fear in our lives. Because some part of us knows the illusion is an illusion. Some part of us knows that something's amiss. Some part of us knows that as sincerely as we believe the separateness illusion, and even though we would defend it sometimes to the death, some part of us knows it doesn't work, and it's not ever going to work. As long as I keep building my life on illusion, some part of me knows I am in danger. I should be afraid. As long as I keep building my life on this illusion, some part of me knows I am under threat, and I should be afraid. Some part of me knows that life isn't going to work out, and I should be afraid. Truth doesn't stop being true just because I am sincere in my disbelief. Reality doesn't stop being reality because I believe something else. If reality is oneness and I build my life on the basis of two-ness, I'm going to be on the losing side of that equation when push comes to shove. So I should be afraid. And we are afraid. And we are carriers of a deep and abiding terror because we live in the world as the world is not. Building separate lives is dangerous. Building independent lives does threaten our well-being. And some deep part of us knows that. And so, some part of us carries a deep sense of fear. So if our tradition is going to tell us how to get out of the experience of fear that is so common to many, our tradition is going to point us to our connectedness one to another. Our tradition intuited this a long time ago and wrote back to us to warn us not to fall into the separateness illusion. The ancient wisdom is built right into our ancient texts. The ancient wisdom points us toward reality as reality is. Listen to how Jesus taught it in a very practical way a few verses later in that Sermon on the Mount. If you're engaged in a religious practice, maybe you're practicing generosity, maybe you're making an offering. If, as you do, you realize that you are divided from your brother or your sister, stop. Leave your religious practice where it is. The practice is important, but there are things more important. Two-ness living in a oneness reality will destroy you. So go immediately. Make things right with your brother or sister. Go immediately. Restore the connection between you. Next week, we're going to look at some of the upsides and the downside of this long tradition that we have of Western individualism. We're going to look at where it came from and how it got here. But if you're under the age of 30 right now, you are questioning the whole culture that brought us as a society to where we are. And you notice that by people under the age of 30 having a strong emphasis on restitching the torn fabric of community. That's kind of a buzzword these days, rebuilding community. People are choosing their life, their living situations. People are choosing their working situations on the basis of how do we rebuild community. Community is a good thing. Everybody wants to be part of community. But our tradition says that it's more than a nice thing. Our tradition teaches us it's an essential thing. It's an essential to live the way the world is kind of thing. Community positions us in the world as the world truly is. So you came to church today on a snowy day, on a daylight savings day, and that's a good practice. That's a healthy practice. Maybe this week you'll take up your Lenten practice. You're doing something to engage or not doing something to disengage from mindless practice. And that will be a good practice, and that will be a healthy practice. But if, as you're engaged in church today, or if, as you're engaged in your Lenten practice tomorrow, it comes to your mind that there is a divide between you and your brother, that there is a divide between you and your sister, that there is a divide between you and your neighbor, Jesus offers you an imperative. Stop. Stop what you're doing now because there's something greater at risk. Living in reality as not will destroy you. So stop what you're doing and go fix it. Stop what you're doing, Paul said it, in as much as you can. Because, you know, there are two parties often in divides. But in as much as you are able, go make it right. go restore oneness where there is a broken place. And so, Holy Spirit of God, may we live in reality as reality is. May we be able to access the non-intuitive reality of oneness and get beyond that persistent illusion of two-ness. And then may we live in the practical outflow of that deeper bedrock truth and dedicate ourselves to the implications that the people who are in our lives, our family and our friends and our neighbors, that being connected to them and not divided from them, loving our neighbor with the same passion with which we love ourselves, that this is the implication of truth as truth is. And may we be carriers of that truth, and may we be those who live out the implications of that truth. Be it so in us, may that flow through us to our community, and may we be carriers of that same peacemaking capacity to the world around us. In Jesus' name, amen.